Welcome to Dragons, Gazelles, and Unicorns, a podcast by Center for Advancement and Innovation. I'm Rosemary Truman, founder and CEO of the Center for Advancement and Innovation, and I'm thrilled to have Kathy Koo on the podcast today. She is sincerely one of the most recognized people in technology transfer and truly a legend. I think she's probably worked every deal you could possibly do. She's been 27 years with us at Stanford and grew that technology transfer center into a powerhouse, bringing in $1.8 billion, I recall seeing. She is now a partner with Wilson Sonsini, and they are very, very lucky to have her. So thank you very much, Kathy. I'm thrilled to have you, and I can't wait to have your valuable insights come out. So thank you for joining.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me to participate.
Oh, gosh, you're so welcome. So, Kathy, how did you get into technology transfer?
Oh, this was totally fortuitous event. I had many, many jobs before, and I would get bored with them every, you know, 1 or 2 years and change jobs. And so I saw this ad for patent engineer. I happened to be an engineer. I happened to have filed the patent as an inventor when I worked at Monsanto. And so it sounded interesting. It was the first ever position at Stanford with that kind of responsibility. And my responsibility at the time, or at least the job description, was to meet with inventors and help them disclose their inventions. So it sounded like an interesting job, and I was looking for something because I had been working in a job that was really boring. So I took this one in a lark. It was just by chance.
And then stayed for 27 years. How many deals did you do?
Oh, I have no idea how many I did. I grew up as a licensing associate, and then I became director. So I was director for 27 years, but I was with the office probably close to 10 years prior to that.
Okay, well, you built the 9 principles in technology transfer, and that was kind of a foundation that you built that a lot of other universities adopted. Can you walk us through how you developed those 9 principles and what they are?
The principles were developed because one of the universities that we were working with had decided that they wanted to get the other universities to license their technologies. And that was the impetus for creating a meeting, because I didn't want universities to spend a lot of time licensing each other for technologies that we would be using in our own. I felt that was not a good use of time, but I thought we needed a broader discussion around that. You know, were we going to require licenses from each other, or could we move past that? And so my boss at the time, Artie Bienenstock, he was the dean of research, I said, we've never had a meeting with just tech transfer people and their deans, the people that we report to. And it would be really good if we could all sit in one room together and discuss some tech transfer issues. You know, all the deans at the universities would talk to their own tech transfer offices, but to get together as a group was going to be a unique event. With his backing, he invited the deans of research, and we invited the tech transfer office, and we had a really wonderful discussion. Part of the discussion is, you know, were we going to let each other use each other's university licenses, technologies, without having to take licenses? And that was one of the basic principles that we said. In one of the principles, it was that we would retain rights for each other to practice inventions, i.e. we wouldn't let our licensees sue each other either. So that was a very, very important point. Another one was that we wanted to make sure that we were transferring technology for the public good. And we wanted to make sure that licensees to be diligent, that they would really try to develop the technology, and that this was not about making money per se, but it was about transferring technology from the universities. So that was really important. We wanted to make sure that we could limit future improvements. One of the issues has always been that licensees, and understandably, would want improvements in perpetuity. You know, if there was a license to a technology, then any improvements that would come up would go to that company, and then 5 years, 10 years down the line, is that a reasonable thing to do? Mm-hmm. And saying we should limit it, that faculty change their research directions a lot of times. The companies change their directions, that we should limit the time period within which improvements would be given to a company. Another point was that conflict of interest is sort of a coordinated with technology transfer. We create conflicts of interest in licensing faculty companies. And so we want to work closely with our conflict of interest people and help manage conflict of interest and be very engaged in the process. The fifth point was that we should ensure that research tools would be broadly available. The NIH has issued guidelines on making research tools available to each other researchers, and we wanted to put that in writing that we were committed to that principle. Mm-hmm. The sixth principle had to do with enforcement, that we should always be mindful that we don't want to litigate just for the sake of litigation.
Right. And
we know that we want to enable our licensees to practice the invention and to enforce patents, but we wanted basically to make sure that the universities are considering this carefully before they really get into litigation. Wanted people to be mindful of export regulations. This was a time when exporting U.S. technology to non-U.S. countries was sort of an issue. So we wanted to make sure that in our technology transfer activities, because we're often dealing with very high-tech technologies, that we would be careful with our export responsibilities. The eighth point was interesting, and it's still a question. There are patent aggregators who want to acquire patents just for the sake of suing others, basically.
Right, right.
And we said that the universities would be very careful about dealing with patent aggregators. Yeah. We want people to develop the technology. We don't want to use patents as a blunt force to just make money. Mm-hmm. The last one was a very nice point. We wanted to make sure that populations who are either neglected or there are a lot of unmet needs in geographical areas, that we would be mindful of that, that we wanted to make sure that underserved populations would not be hurt by our technology licensing practices. Mm-hmm. So most universities now have provision that says if the licensee is not meeting a need, and they will try to, you know, enable these underserved populations to get the technology in a good way.
Mm-hmm. These are amazing. So the improvements one in perpetuity, you know, as you license the invention, then of course the licensee wants to get the improvements. So yeah. What would happen if someone gets an exclusive license to an invention? It is updated, it now hits that point in time when you are not providing any more improvements, but yet the invention still moves forward and has more improvements. What happens with that technology if it's is it the case that you only do that if it's non-exclusive?
Well, we would go both ways, but if there's an improvement and the period of, you know, obligation has ended, mm-hmm. if there's an improvement, we would market the technology. And if no one else wants it, and often no one else will want it because the background patent is held by a licensee, then we could grant either a non-exclusive or exclusive license to the improvement. But it was this automatic feeding of improvements into the licensee that we were trying to stop. Mm-hmm. And again, many times the improvement has diverged from the original technology. And so maybe somebody else might want this quoted improvement, but it's really a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
This gave us more flexibility.
I think that we could have 9 separate podcasts on each one of these topics. I might ask you to do that. So what was the impact or the implication as it relates to the licensing inventions to populations that are neglected what immediately comes to mind is infectious diseases, you know, malaria, tuberculosis, right. And things of that nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
So would you be giving those inventions to researchers that could implement a treatment or a diagnostic or something of that sort, and they're not using it, of course, to make money?
So some of the licenses would say that if you're selling in countries that really can't afford healthcare prices that the West can, or the developed countries can, that they would make that those things available at a much, let's say, lower price, reasonably priced for that population. There are all sorts of, underserved diseases that the population could use therapies, cures, but they can't afford it. So mm-hmm. we would ask the licensee to be sure to be mindful of that. So some licensees are very willing to say, we're going to, you know, make therapies or devices at cost to these countries.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to try to recap the 9 items that you mentioned. I was typing them down. So,
yeah.
So you have one that you're going to be licensing or transferring technology for the public good.
Yeah.
Universities are not going to license to each other.
Right.
For pushing forward their inventions. They're not going to sue each other.
Right.
There's a limit in the obligation for improvements in perpetuity. There's a focus on conflict of interest avoidance.
For the conflict of interest, it's not necessarily avoidance, but to help
manage it. Okay. Yeah. So, and then also ensuring research tools are broadly available through research agreements.
Yes. Well, a lot of times the tools we would make available non-exclusively.
Right.
That would
be
the mechanism.
And then you would manage enforcement to mitigate or manage, to figure out when you're going to litigate and not litigate. Not
right.
Litigate all the time. Manage export regulation, because you have to be very careful about, with the NASA work that we did, we have a list of countries that we would not be able to license to. So we had to manage actually everyone coming into our challenge, which is called the Space Race Challenge. So yes. Very familiar with that. NIH is different and they're much broader. Beware patent trolls or
right.
patent aggregators. And then the last one is, make sure that populations that are neglected but could actually license inventions that can be helpful to them and avoid licensing to populations that are neglected to be harmful.
The universities for that last provision
yes.
would say that sales in the U.S. would be a certain royalty, but sales in certain other countries might be zero. So even
okay.
though you would not take royalties.
So the licensing is like an art and a science. You get very. What is the most creative kind of license that you've ever come up with?
Oh, I don't know what the creative one is, but there are all sorts of both financial and provisional clauses that you can play with. So of course the financials is what most people focus on, but you can play off monies early on versus monies later on. You can mitigate the risk. Payments come in at a later stage as opposed to the early stage, because again most of the technology is a very early stage and mm-hmm. it's quite risky. So maybe as they're de-risk and it's proven out, then you get more payments. Those clauses such as unmet needs, those are always interesting to negotiate. Is it a royalty-based obligation, or is it just, do you leave it fairly fuzzy and leave it up to the licensee? Many, many of the terms, we might say, let's meet and discuss as mm-hmm. things change. Because again, typically, a company will have an intent at the beginning, and over years that it changes.
Mm-hmm.
So again, a good license might really be amended many times during its life. Creative part is trying to solve the issues of the licensee versus the principles and the policies of a university. And how do you find solutions that are good for both sides?
What do you think the biggest choke points are in licensing?
The biggest checkpoints?
Choke points.
Oh, I think it's the perception of value from each side. Whether the company thinks it's very valuable, the company may or may not think it's very valuable, and the university may have an aligned view or an opposite view. And so that's the negotiation. The other issue generally is that people come into the negotiation with sort of set thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
People will say, what's the average royalty rate or what should we expect? And the trouble is, I often say, what's the average price of a car?
Right.
Well, like, I don't know, what kind of car do you want to buy?
Is it Lamborghini or Audi?
Exactly. And so again, there are comparables out there, but I'm really getting nervous about comparables because each technology is different and how it fits into the product is pretty different and its stage of development is different. So again, coming in to a negotiation with preconceived notions is really hard. But of course, you know, you need some parameters so that you're not too far apart. That's the challenge for licensing.
How do you close the gap?
You keep talking to each other. So, you know, one of the things that I always say to companies now that I'm at Wilson is that they need to think about why, let's say, they think the price is too high. I mean, that's typical. The companies think the price is too high. The universities think the companies aren't paying enough. Mm-hmm. So have rationale for where you're coming from. You can't just pick a number out of the sky and say, I think we should pay 5%. I don't know if 5% is good or bad, depending on the base, depending on the context, et cetera, et cetera. So again, it's not just a bare bones number that makes mm-hmm. the difference of what the number is based on.
What advice would you give companies that are negotiating a license and they're just not seeming to be able to come to closure? You said continue to communicate, but are there any best practices that you would suggest in that communication?
I again always think that both sides should talk to each other and give the rationale. Let's say the university thinks this is a really hot market and this is a really huge chance to make a big difference in something, then they'll expect a higher royalty. But the company, if it's an early stage company, probably can't afford it. So you try to mitigate along the way and maybe discuss if the future looks this way, then you have a particular financial return. If the future is a different way, then you have a different financial return. Everybody focuses on the finances a lot. You have to come together as to what the assumptions are so that you're on the same page.
And what do you think the future of technology transfer is? If you were to look in your crystal ball and say 10 years from now, this is the way the landscape is going to look.
It is a really interesting thing. Years ago, probably in the 1990s, I thought, oh, you know, this is as big as it's going to get. And I just see that, one, there's a lot of interest in startups and economic development regionally. And clearly, startup and university tech transfer is one of the areas of growth. So I think it's just going to get bigger and bigger. Universities over these last 30 years of Bayh-Dole have become much more sophisticated mm-hmm. in the actual process of technology licensing university to companies. Now I think the growth will be in developing the ecosystem, developing entrepreneurs who understand how the ecosystem works, and getting a cadre of experienced people. I think many of the regions that are not quite as entrepreneurial as the coasts are trying to do this, and they will develop over time. It takes time. It takes time to grow a generation of entrepreneurs who are then experienced, who can then help the new ones come forward. But I think this whole growth is going to come. The U.S. is very innovative and really at the forefront. And so, again, I think that there's just an unfettered, bright future for tech licensing.
Well, you know, that's the thing that we think, and that's what we do, building talent to take these inventions sitting on the shelf board, and we see it spreading. I just mentioned to you before we started the podcast, we just got back from London, and this is the first time we've done a deal with a UK or a foreign entity, and it's called the Brain Tumor Charity.
Uh-huh.
And we're doing the brain race, basically spinning out companies to improve the quality of life for people with brain tumors. So it's very exciting to see lots of ecosystems. We have an ambassador network of about uh-huh. 55 people around the world, and that's what their whole kind of job, they're volunteers. Thank God for them. They're very generous with their time. But we have people planted in different locations around the world to galvanize the ecosystems there, to basically pull in accelerators and incubators, or if they're, they don't exist, make connections with ones that are, that can actually help some of the entrepreneurs. What's fascinating is that, as you know, we have an accelerator program, which is about 40 classes, 12 company building exercises, 16 weeks to hot seats, you know, and a bunch of homework assignments. And so we use that as the training platform, and it's virtual. So 46% of the people who enter our challenge are from underserved, underprivileged ecosystems. So we're getting into those as well. And that's really where it's really important to have those ambassadors to help, you know, pull together parts of the ecosystem that can identify where the resources lie. So, I continue to hope we scale our challenges and the number of entrepreneurs that we bring into our challenges. So, you know, when you developed these nine principles, did you realize how much adoption there would be? Everybody kind of had wanted to see your best practices, and because you were so successful in developing them. Did you anticipate that?
Absolutely not. It was such a surprise. I mean, and it's thrilling. But after this meeting, which was a very good day-long meeting, one of the participants, David Korn, has suggested that we write something up. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, many of us have lots of meetings, but we don't do something with the meeting. So we ended up writing up these 9 points and just having the participants sign it. Because again, we did this outside of Autumn, the university group, because we felt that this should be a statement by a certain group of universities, and that we could propagate this statement sort of independently of any formal organization. And so we just wrote it up, and then we circulated it, basically. It took a little bit of time, but, you know, we came up with this document sort of like a pledge of allegiance. It wasn't, you had to adhere to it or anything like this. And then as it got more and more publicity and sort of favorable review, then Autumn sort of took it on, and they enabled many, many people to sign up for it. So no, we never expected this to be anything necessarily, but just a statement by this small group of people at first. And now I'm thrilled that it has over 100 and some signatories.
Cool. That's really cool. So now that you're at Wilson Sonsini, has your perspective on technology transfer changed?
It hasn't changed. I've always been interested in trying to make it better, even from the university sector. That's always what I was dedicated to. And so from the company side, now I see that it's just really hard for these startup companies to raise money. And in a lot of ways, the university license is just the beginning of this long, long journey for most of these companies. And so I have gotten a lot more sympathy for these startup companies. I realize that the license is the first step, and then they will just have to continue constantly to try to find investment so they can develop the technology, which is what the university should want too. So now I feel even more strongly that a successful startup reflects well on the university, and that the university should want their startups to be successful and should help them be successful, rather than put too much obligation and responsibilities that they can't meet.
Well, that's wonderful, because Tom Stackhouse, we had on the podcast, he's the head of tech transfer at the National Cancer Institute. He said that as well. So I'm very happy to hear that, because our teams are going through the technology transfer process right now, licensing the brain tumor conventions that we have, as well as our other challenge called SCALE. It stands for Supply Chain and Logistics Enterprises. So teams are starting the process, and you're right, it is the first step. They've gone through this gauntlet of 8 months of accelerator training. We've bolted on all these mentors to them. Now they're at the end, and they're licensing. And on the funding front, what we have been doing with our entrepreneurs is putting them, one of the homework assignments is to find 5 startup competitions. Because our teams are, they win a lot of them. So by the end of the challenge, they have some money in their pocket, which is good.
That's great.
So not diluted money in their pocket.
That's great.
And we're going to actually end with an investor forum. We have one coming up in Northwest Arkansas because the Walton Family Foundation has generously supported the Scale Challenge. And we're very excited about that. We have about 150 investors from all around the world coming to that. And then our brain race that the teams are going to present at Bio. And we're making a lot of personal introductions to investors, mostly family offices and super angels for our startups because they're not ready for venture capital yet.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to wind things up here, what are the things I haven't asked you that you think people on this podcast should know about technology transfer?
I feel like technology transfer is a contact sport. You have to talk with each other. And it's not just a piece of paper. And that licensing, for example, is a long-term relationship. And I've been pushing that the relationship is the important thing to preserve. That you talk to the university often. The university should talk to the company often and find out what's going on. And that one changes the terms of the agreement sometimes based on changing circumstances because we're entering into an agreement that is at least 20 years long, if it's an exclusive license. And lots of things happen within 20 years. And so I feel like being flexible is really important, listening to the other side, and really, trying to work at this together to make the licensee successful. Because if the licensee is successful and brings a product to the marketplace, then everybody wins.
And when you say the relationship, you mean the relationship between the technology transfer office and the licensee, but probably the inventor has some influence into the relationship at times.
Sure. And the inventor, if they want to be involved in, let's say, a startup, then they should be involved, and that relationship is really, really important. And the inventors can choose on a personal level how much they want to be involved and how long they want to be involved for. But again, as the company grows and becomes, let's say, more of a development company, sometimes the inventors just step back a little bit and they watch the company grow without being heavily involved at the early stage. But I think it's up to each inventor to decide, how much involvement they want.
Well, I have one last question. So out of all of your career in managing, directing the technology transfer office, what's the most exciting deal that you or your team ever did?
Is it about money or is it about fame? So, of course, Google. The well-known one, and it was an exciting deal, but we didn't know it was exciting at the time. That's the thing. One of the things that I feel very importantly from a university tech transfer is we can't pick the winners. We don't always know which ones are going to be big winners. The one that was most challenging and most surprising was this thing called functional antibodies. It was a shared invention with Columbia. It took 14 years for the patent to issue in the patent office.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Oh, my gosh.
We've given up on it, basically.
Yeah. Wow.
Was a stick-to-itiveness person, and she got the patent.
That's excellent.
And it was under the old rules, 17 years from date of issuance.
So
we had 14 plus 17 years, and it was our biggest moneymaker for Stanford. But it is a technology that probably no one realizes is the basis for a lot of antibody technology.
That is an amazing story.
Yeah.
Wow. Goodness gracious. God bless her. Well, Kathy, I just want to thank you very, very much for your time today and your extremely valuable insights and the stories as well. So I can't tell you how privileged I feel to have you on the podcast. And have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.